This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Way back when I was in college, I had the rare privilege of studying writing from someone known as a writer's writer, from John McPhee. If you're a lit major like I was, you studied with literary historians and literary critics and scholars, but rarely writers of the first order. Such was John McPhee.
I never had any other ambition than to write. And I tell a story which is about 94% true.
Good enough.
To wit, is that okay?
Yeah.
Which is that I was a little kid with a football shirt on, and I would run out on the field with the Princeton football team all the time when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And I was there every game. And one November day, when I was about eight, there was a driving rain, a almost horizontal rain with the wind in it, ice cold on that football sideline. It was horrible. And I looked up at the press box, and I knew that those people up there were not only sheltered, but had space heaters. And I decided then and there to become a writer. Okay, that's 94% true.
Yeah.
So it seemed to be a place of privilege. A place where you had warm shoes and warm socks and you'd be okay, and yet you could observe life.
I had a mistaken idea about writing altogether at that point, looking up at the press box. I thought all you did was sort of move your fingers around and make money doing it.
That's not it?
That's not it.
I was misinformed.
I'm glad.
McPhee didn't exactly spend his career keeping his feet dry and warm. He's 85 now, and he's written about every corner of the American landscape, from the muddy orange groves of Florida to the Alaska gold country. And he's not what you'd call a political activist, but at the same time, he's written about the environment with real penetration. He's written about nuclear weapons and energy, the degradation of the natural world, and in a five-volume work that won the Pulitzer Prize, it's called The Annals of the Former World, he writes about the very earth we stand on, its geology. McPhee has lived his entire life in Princeton, New Jersey, and he's been teaching at Princeton University for decades. But he gets around to do his work, to report his masterpiece coming into the country, his book about the Alaska frontier. He traveled the wilderness by canoe and plane. He went by helicopter and on foot, even by dog team. So we just pulled down a volume from your top shelf up there it's a bound copy of notes, typed up notes from your Alaska trips in the mid-70s. And they're meticulously typed up notes with photographs of people you saw and scenery and points of interest in Alaska. How did you invent this process for doing what you needed to do beginning in the mid-60s?
Invented it?
Yeah.
These are my notes. I typed them up.
No, but this system, oh my God, is this where you lived?
Where? No, that's Wilkinson's thing. He was a gold miner, and he worked that creek. And that was his cabin. And I went in there and saw him, and he had a Jiffy peanut butter jar, whatever it is, yeah, full of gold.
God, help us.
I brought home four nuggets from up there that somebody like Wilkinson had taken out of the stream. And these four nuggets are on gold chains that my four daughters have. the point being that a placer gold miner can look at a nugget and tell what stream it came from. It's amazing.
So most of your books, most of your pieces have books like this, volumes like this?
Have a collection of notes like this. If you have the idea where you're going to start, where you're going to end, and how you're going to go in between from each of the components, you then take those notes that you had previously made and not referred to while you're building this structure, and then you assign each part of the notes to some area or another of the structure.
I think if a non-writer heard you talking about this like this, they would think, this sounds an awful lot like, I don't know, construction or, you know, something very highly rational, something not magical, something not quote-unquote creative. Where does the magical fit in?
I'll tell you my response to that. It sounds mechanical, but what it does is free you to write. So it has just the opposite effect. You go through all that stuff. Then when I'm in here, however long it takes me to get going, I know just what I want to write. And I know from the notes what it is. And mm-hmm. It's just in my head. And then what I do, if the 2 hours I write or the 3 hours that I'm actually writing, I'm totally free of worrying about any other part of this great big thing because of having been through this mechanical thing first.
Yeah.
So its effect is exactly the opposite of some mechanistic dum-dum.
So you're looking back at what you've done, and you have to see that there's some kind of pattern in subject as well. And but I'd also say that, and you might not like this, that it adds up to a political dimension too, especially when it comes to the environment.
I think that's true, because I spent my summers, all summer, in a canoe tripping camp. Off we went into the woods with the canoes. And a huge percentage of the pieces that I've done in The New Yorker derive from that kind of thing, interest, including, for example, going to Alaska. And Alaska is not exactly Vermont, but I didn't mm-hmm. know it.
But did you feel any political impulse about being, at least in part?
About environmentalism or what became called environmentalism and so forth.
Or did it not seem that way in the beginning?
Yes, no, it seemed that way because this place was a classroom of the woods.
Your camp.
They were teaching what's now called, you know, ecology and stuff like that, when ecology meant the root and shoot relationships of plants.
Mm-hmm.
I have been called an agricultural writer, a nature writer, a sports writer. Keep going, wherever these things that I've done are. But what all my pieces have in common is that they're about real people in real places. I'm writing about the people, and then I tell a reader what I learn and what I want the reader to know about that person's passions and interests.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't start with a desire to write about nature. It starts with a desire to write about people.
So you write a book called The Founding Fish, which is about shad. And what's the origin of that?
Fishing with my father when I was a kid. But I took it up again when I got interested in the shad run in the Delaware River, which is 15 miles from where we're doing this talk.
Now, I want you to say this on the radio from coast to coast. How many shad have you caught in your life?
1,281.
Damn. 14.
I happen to know. Let me tell you something that happened. I went to Kunkelly with George Hackle. We caught 30-some shad sitting there.
You just sat there for
the
afternoon?
We sat there. We never moved the boat 1 foot. And we sat there.
That's because you caught the same fish over and over again.
We were sitting in those rapids, and we caught one after another.
You told me that when you came to The New Yorker and said, I want to write about geology, the reaction of William Shawn, who was the editor at that time, was not exactly a standing ovation.
Yeah.
What was it?
I told him I wanted to write about geology, and he goes, well, readers will rebel.
And he then thought you were gone for a year. And in you went on your biggest project, really, of your writing life. Why did you do that? Because they did, some of them did rebel.
I fell into a situation that that broadened and deepened as I went along. My first suggestion was to go up somewhere near New York and write about a road cut and write about the provenance of the rock and its age and its origins and stuff like that with a geologist, talk of the town, see? Mm-hmm. Over and done with in 3 days.
1,000 words, done.
And I'm going to this outcrop. And then Ken DeFaze, a Princeton geologist, agreed to do this with me. And thinking about it, meanwhile, I said, what if we went to more than one road cut? What if we went up the Adirondack Northway, which is such a beautiful road with these huge exposures of rock? And DeFaze says, not on this continent. He said, if you want to do a piece like that where you move along, go across the structure. Don't go along with the structure. You go up the Adirondack Northway, and it's all in North of Sight and everything else, and you're in Montreal. And so then I got the idea, ooh, what if you go across the country? All this happening within a week or two. And this Talk of the Town piece changed into what eventuated as 20 years of work. Now, if I had...
How did William Sean react to that?
Sean might rebel. I don't know. He was okay with that.
Did you care? Did you care that an audience might have wanted X as opposed to Y? Or were you in such a position and in such a state of mind that you were able to follow your interests absolutely from the beginning to the... to where we are now in
the
your
latter.
Career.
I mean, never market research your pieces. I mean, I wasn't worried about what the audience would think. If you're enthusiastic enough about the piece yourself, people will become interested with you. And the reaction in the geology is really curious because, yes, readers did rebel, but also...
How did you feel the rebellion?
Also, you got... some lawyer in Boston writes to me and says... please stop writing about geology in big letters on his legal letterhead. Mm-hmm. And I did not write to him and say, you know, what we could use is one less lawyer and I nominate you. I didn't do that. I just did nothing. But reaction from readers to the geology work is the strongest of anything I've ever done.
No kidding.
The positive side, absolutely. It's amazing. And they're still coming along. I opened one up on my way in here just now. When I came up here to my office where we are, there was somebody had pasted to my door an obituary. And this man's favorite book was Annals of the Former World. And that kind of thing happens with some frequency.
Where this, one of the things I learned to think about in your class was the way you could inscribe in a narrative a set piece, a descriptive set piece of, in your case, a bear, or even could be an essay. And there's a kind of essay on deep time in the geology work. And the readers really responded to that in a very special way.
It's an essay on time, the time of the earth, the time of the universe, the time, geologic time, how geologic time was established, what people thought in 1795. They literally thought the earth was about 2,400 years old, something like that, and describes what Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, and so forth are all about, and how many years ago they started and finished, and why they move on to the next one. At any rate, I've gotten a number of letters from cancer patients having read that essay, that 10,000 words, but mostly the last part of it.
Because they're responding...
It's about the perspective of time, which is so immense that it somehow had a soothing effect.
Let me ask you this. How do you see time in the career of a writer? Life is short. A writing life is short. All of it's short. Obviously, as you get more experienced, it helps you save time and not make the certain kinds of mistakes that you might have when you were 25. How do you feel time as both a drag and as an advantage as you're moving along in a writing and creative life?
I mean, you're right on it. I guess it is both, because I do, at the get-go, on any piece of writing, I have no confidence, anybody, right now, 50 years ago.
No difference.
I have no, well, at the beginning, no confidence. Who am I to be doing this? What kind of a pretentious jerk am I to think that I can talk to the world about something? And on and on and on. See, this is the first draft. The first draft is the longest thing by a factor of about 3 or 4 to 1 over the rest of it. And when you're going through the first draft, you are one miserable creature. But at the end of that time that you're referring to kicks in, and it turns from being sort of grungy to a pleasant experience. And the longer I've been at it, the more pleasant it has become after the first draft, second draft, third draft, fourth draft. I love working on that.
Mm-hmm. You sound miserable when you're writing, or it's a tough process. But if you took a year off, what would happen?
Let me tell you this story, that coming into the country was really tough to do.
Which was a bestseller at that time, right?
The curious thing was, yes, it was. The whole project took about 3 years. And as I was in the last 6 months of that and everything else, I kept saying to myself, if I ever finish this, I am never going to write another line if I ever finish this thing. And I would cuss around up there in my office. And so I finished it. And I was never going to write another line. And this guy in New York calls me up and says he's running this new thing at the time called The Green Market. See?
How long after this? Is it after you've finished your last book?
It was a month. It was in July of that year. And I'd finished this thing in June. And so I'd sworn never to write again. But I went in to do a talk piece on The Green Market. And I went back the next day to The Green Market. And then I put an apron on in Hodgson Farms place and started selling beans. And the thing was that I really did not want to write anymore.
You just wanted to sell beans?
And I didn't write a talk piece. And I just, every once in a while, I'd make a few notes that were in my pocket. But I sold the beans. And this was July when I first went in there, and when I left, there was snow on the ground. And there was a period when I just didn't want to write. I wanted to sell beans.
I have to tell you, I've been hearing you talk like this for more than 35 years. Yeah, and when I first heard it in your classroom, it scared the hell out of me. Because you would talk about how painful it is to write. And then the only thing that rescued me is that I'd then go, well, there wasn't Wikipedia, but I would see there's the bibliography of one book every 18 months or so for, by then, already 20 years and now a great deal longer. So somewhere, somehow, despite the pain of writing, the difficulty of it, the agony of it, which you almost delight in talking about, it always struck to me, but I'm sure it's no delight, things move forward.
If you're there every day, And you go through the process I just described, and then a little, you know, a few paragraphs or one paragraph, whatever, goes into the bucket like a drop of water. And every day, after 365 days, you got a bucket full of water, and call it a book, and then get on to the next one.
John, you began teaching at Princeton when?
1975.
Now, up on your shelves, I see books by former students, and there's loads of them. How did this? It must be stunning to you.
It's there could be lots more. I mean, it's just amazing that I'm looking at a bookshelf, and every book in it was written by a former student. Every one over there. Over there, there's two more shelves. Every book was written by a former student. But let me tell you this: on top of one of these bookshelves here, in at the very top, there's only a freight car. And this freight car is sitting at the tip top of a shelf. Why? Because Ann Tarbutton is the president of the railroad. She was in this class. And my message to the students is, if you can be the president of a railroad, do that. If you can't, write the books that are underneath, but that's the priority.
John McPhee, fishing enthusiast, railroad enthusiast, rock enthusiast, kind of an everything enthusiast. We mentioned a few books in passing, and you can find all the titles we talked about and more at newyorkerradio.org.